Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do video games distract our kids from building social and academic skills and knowledge, or do they have the potential to actually enhance performance in school and enhance the ability to cope with real-life challenges? The more scientists and educators learn about how young people interact with online games, the more potential they are discovering in these platforms as genuinely useful tools for learning. And universities are stepping up to develop and grow programs that will educate the next generation of game designers and programmers who often have goals that far exceed simple entertainment. Tom Linehan is director of the Institute for Interactive Arts and Engineering at UT Dallas. Peter Rodd is director of the Linda and Mitch Hart E-Center at Guildhall at SMU. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So I think most parents would agree that if their kids have the same passion for studying biology and spelling and algebra that they have for playing their favorite games, everybody would be very well off. Is it possible to make educational games as addictive as, like, Final Fantasy?
I don't know that I would use the word addictive. That's got different connotations. But
appealing.
Appealing. Definitely. I think the key to video games is in the arena, well, two arenas. One is the notion of motivation. Once we're motivated, then we're much more likely to want to participate in learning, because learning is difficult. It's not an easy endeavor. So if we're motivated to learn, then we're much likely to want to learn and pay the price, if you will, actually, for that learning. And secondly, the learning through a video game, because it's exploratory and personally driven, leads us to much deeper learning, meaning learning that actually not only sticks, but learning that I can use in situations that I haven't come across before. So for those two reasons and many others, yes, video games can be a tremendous platform for education.
Are students who are trying to do this as a career also learning about child development and the way people learn?
There's an emerging psychology where scientists are systematically studying video gaming. One of the important fields of research, I think, has been developed by a Canadian psychologist named Berline. And Berline has studied the effects of conflict, arousal, and curiosity. He, in fact, has a book out by that name. And looking at what is it that prompts our attentiveness, what draws our attention, what feeds our curiosity, how do we resolve conflict, how do we reestablish a kind of equilibrium, maintaining a balance and yet a sense of control, how do we push ourselves harder? And all of those things sound very attractive to me as an educator. They're human dimensions that we'd like to see more of in the classroom, I think. The attentiveness, the sense of control, the systematic pushing of one another to a higher level of performance.
You know, I think that's so interesting, Tom, because a lot of people assume that video games take all those things away. They assume that they create kids who have no attention span and really don't want to pay attention. And yet, if you really watch kids playing these, if they want badly enough to get to the next level of something, they can play, if not interrupted by other things, for hours on end.
Mm-hmm. There's a great difference between watching someone play a game and playing a game. Mm-hmm. Because you don't feel any of those kinds of empowerments by just watching other people play. So part of it is that parents are oftentimes found in the watching mode, and the child is fully immersed and in the dynamic, highly interactive mode. And it may not be visible that they are, in fact, at the fourth level trying to achieve some critical score. To the parent and to the teacher, it can appear as though they're simply ignoring them.
Yeah, and there's garbage to be taken out and homework to be done, but in fact, they're still pushing. Right. So how do you translate that passion for a particular game to one that may be teaching math concepts or social studies or something important?
The key is to make sure that a video game remains a video game. I think some of the early attempts at serious games or educational games were either in the edutainment arena, like why don't we entertain you about mathematics or about physics or about literature, to the point where maybe we had video games that were forced. I think it's really important, several. One, we have to realize that we don't truly understand yet what the magic is, what the magic formula is. Secondly, we need to realize that not everything can be gamified, if you will, turned into a game. There are certainly still subject matters that are much better taught and learned in other forms of education and delivery. But it is here is a nugget, basically, of what makes it extremely useful. If I'm motivated to understand how the chemistry set can create something that I'm interested in, or I'm motivated how to fix my bicycle so I can go ride it, it turns out that I, as a human being, will pay whatever price is necessary in terms of spending the time and the effort in order for me to learn the things that I need to learn in order to make that happen. But if I am in that environment and somebody is actually forcing me to do it, then I actually lose the interest. And so there are two issues here that have to be balanced in video games for education. One is the content useful and educational? And is it presented in a certain way or in a way that the child feels that they're actually in the driver's seat, that they're actually the ones that are exploring for their own benefit? And if we make it fun in that way and make sure that the content is educational and builds toward whatever it is that we want to build toward, then I think we would have a winning recipe. But as you were alluding to and Tom talked about, the field of research is still extremely nascent, and we really do not understand yet what all goes on in the brain when we're learning through video games. It's a very exciting time for us.
Young children from very early on can recognize when they're presented with false choices. It's not a real choice at all. And so those of us in education who've been trying to reap the benefits of game structure for instruction haven't always done so well. You know, our early attempts fell more into the false choice. We want students to know this kind of information. And when that happens, the immersion goes away. The child loses interest and so on. So doing this well is the target. It's what we have to learn to do in education.
I read some really interesting research that had found that, you know, one thing we do know about video games is that there's a sort of relationship to dopamine, and if things are going well, you get this little reward. Men, and we're talking about adults here, men seem to get a much bigger squirt of dopamine from playing these games than women. Of course, that's a generalization, but do we need to think about making different games for boys and girls in classrooms to teach the same concepts?
Well, definitely. I think we already know from video games for entertainment that the video games that are attractive to females are not in the same proportions attractive to males and vice versa. So I think we need to ask the same. We already know that we all learn in different ways, and there are, you know, auditory learners and visual learners, and obviously video games can be highly educational. But I think to just say that there is one size fits all, or there's one particular game that is going to be attractive to everybody, I think it falls back into the same easy solutions that we always want. I mean, at the end of the day, why are we talking about this? Because there is a chasm, there is a dichotomy at this point of view, at this point in time, between traditional academia, which was set up for efficiency, if nothing else. It's highly efficient, it's didactic, it's simplified, it is set into these modules, which could be months or years or whatever, and you do book one, and then you do book two, and then you do book three.
And the model's 150 years old.
And the model is hundreds of years old. Actually, you can just go back to the, you know, even 800 AD. So that model works, and we're comparing it to a model in which learning is nonlinear, learning is exploratory. Notice I'm saying learning, not never teaching. It's all based on the individual who's actually doing the learning as opposed to what I would like to teach. There's already a dichotomy. On one side, we have the traditional, which is easy. We understand how to do it. We've already simplified it and made it highly linear and didactic, and we know what happens on Tuesday and what happens on Thursday, what happens next year, versus the other one, which is completely almost uncontrollable to us and scary to us because we don't know how to control the learning that is taking place. And yet, when we go back to want to create a video game, we say, well, maybe we should have one video game for all the kids. Well, some kids enjoy third-person adventure type game. Another kid might enjoy what's known as a first-person shooter. Another kid might really enjoy being in a kind of an exploratory garden where things are presented to them. So we do need to remain open that we all want different kinds of experiences, and therefore the video games would have to be different for all of us.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you'd like to be part of this conversation. We're talking about video games as used in education with Tom Linehan, who is director of the Institute for Interactive Arts and Engineering at UT Dallas, and Peter Rodd, director of the Linda and Mitch Hart E-Center at the Guildhall at SMU. We'll resume this conversation in a couple of minutes. We're going to take a quick break now to ask you to go online, if that is your thing. Go to online to kera.org, make a contribution of financial support there. For this particular episode of Think and for all the others that you hear throughout the year. You can also make a contribution at 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is here now. Were you a video game kid?
Yeah, but I mean, it goes so, you know, I'm so old.
Were you playing Oregon Trail?
It was like, no, it was, you know, I remember it when Intellivision came out, you know, and we were Atari people before that, but then that's kind of where it stopped.
You learned nothing from Pac-Man, is what you're saying.
No, not, and I never really got. I mean, my favorite video game was probably always Galaga, or something like that. But we never really got into having the systems. My friends in the neighborhood had them, but I never really got there. I mean, now if we got Justin Martin in here, he could tell you about every video game release and what it grossed and all that stuff, because the guy knows everything there is to know about it. But you know, it's part of the deal, and. In this modern world that we live in.
Sort of exciting.
Yeah. I mean, at least I know how to work a computer.
There you go.
All right.
You learned that.
Did I pass? Can I stay?
Well, it's fun to be able to have this conversation about something that we used to think of as just you know, a time killer, or you know, something that we created just to have fun. And now, you know, it's always fascinating to look at the next generation of things and the changes that are being made. This discussion today is part of that. The potential for this technology, your support, your financial support of this station allows us to have not just this conversation, but many different ones like it across a wide variety of academic disciplines and across, you know, the political spectrum. Your money makes it possible at kera.org and at 1-888-694-6931.
If you just look at the public safety and military applications alone of sort of the interactive
flight simulators.
Well, not they're doing full. I mean, there's full combat going on now, and the guys flying the planes are in Arizona. And, you know, our theaters of operations aren't in Arizona, Chris. I mean, they're elsewhere in real time. So, you know, that's the reality of the virtual reality world now. And I think that we try to make sure that we cover these kinds of things on the show on a regular basis. And this is happening right here in our own backyard. And we're thrilled to have the professors here today because, well, it's a topic that I think that you who listens to this station, get something out of this and these kinds of conversations. And, you know, that's who we do it for. We do this for you. We're not making the show for us. We're making the show for you. And what Chris and I do every day is we say, when we weigh a potential guest or potential topic, we say, hey, what's the audience going to get out of this? And then more importantly, when we come to you during membership time, are you willing to pay for it?
Yeah, and your support is really critical because, you know, you love a lot of the national programs that we have on this station. This particular hour is so interesting because it's something that is happening in North Texas that has really potentially global implications. You might not hear that on one of the nationally programmed shows, but one that is made for you in North Texas by people who are your friends and neighbors here in North Texas is something that we think has a value. We would love to hear from you now with a contribution of financial support at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931.
Yeah, please don't wait. Please go online right now at kera.org and make your safe and secure contribution there or call 888-694-6931. And thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about video games and potential for learning. My guests this hour are Peter Rodd, who is director of the Linda and Mitch Hart E-Center at the Guildhall at SMU, and Tom Linehan, director of the Institute for Interactive Arts and Engineering at UT Dallas. We would love for you to be part of this conversation. You can do so by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Tom, you have been working on a project with the U.S. Army for several years, and as you mentioned to me in the break, people think this is some kind of shoot-'em-up thing or, as we discussed before, a flight simulator, but in fact, it's a very different kind of program.
It really is. For the last, actually since 2005, UT Dallas researchers have been developing cultural training interactive games for the troops prior to moving into theater. So our focus has been on recreating the kind of environments that they're likely to encounter in Afghanistan or in Iraq. And we literally place the player, the young soldier, inside of an Afghani village, say populated by 200 Afghanis, men, women, and children, different ages, and they come to learn about the Afghani village by meeting people, talking to them, asking questions. And this work has actually been extremely useful, very productive, both for our graduate students and faculty, but for the Army. And soldiers who go through an immersive cultural training prior to arriving in Afghanistan have well-proven advantages.
So would this be recognizable to somebody who plays one of those, I guess they're fantasy role-playing games where, you know, you get to the front door and you're offered three responses that you can give to this person who answers the door and offers you, say, something to eat?
It's like that in the sense that you don't control who's going to be walking around, or you do control who you walk up to and try to talk to, depending upon the attitude of that particular Afghani game character. They may talk to you. They may be polite. They may ignore you. They may be very hostile toward you. And so part of it is you're gaining experience in terms of how you handle it. We refer to it as a sandbox game in the sense that there's no pre-scripted scenario of what's going to happen. You kind of make things happen by choices that you make. And the characters make things happen by the model, the behavioral model that they're following. This is actually work that now is directed by Dr. Marge Zilke, and there's teams of researchers involved in ongoing work here.
And how do you keep it interesting? Are there life and death consequences in the game? Is there humor involved, or is it sort of a straight up simulation exercise?
This particular game, you're actually trying to collect information about the village. You're trying to estimate how friendly the village is, if they're potentially participating in any kind of IED production, or what it is that you might do to prove that that there's some interest in their life. Might you help provide clean water to the village? Might you schedule a kind of health intervention day where people can bring children to see the medics and so on? So it really is a kind of community trust building exercise, and you're being scored and evaluated throughout the game, and your final score can be seen by the coach at the end of the game or during the game, and you can see your score throughout the game. So in a sense, you're playing against you know, the fates and the conditions of that environment.
Finally sounds like a video game I might actually be good at if I played long enough. Peter, we were talking earlier about, you know, things in the classroom before we talked about potential military applications. But there are also educational things that we want our kids to learn that may not have anything to do with the day-to-day curriculum. And your staff has been working on something about teen violence, is that right?
Yes, we actually collaborated with our SMU Department of Psychology to look at the violence in dating, or the potential of violence in dating, as well as binge drinking in the fraternity, sorority scene in a university. These are situations that when a young person is presented with, they may not know what to do, and they may actually see the situation escalate to uncomfortable levels, and they've never really had any experience in how to extricate themselves or how to lower the tension, if you will, and remove themselves from these things. In particular, with the game that we did with the psychology department with regard to teen violence, our objective was, you know, the 15, 16, 14-year-old young person, we put them in a situation where they've left the party, they're sitting in a car, they're at the lake, they're actually looking out, it's raining, it's thundering. They don't think they can walk out, actually, but nothing is keeping them from doing that. The suspension of disbelief is so strong in the human being. This is why we can lose hours reading or cry at a movie or things like that. Once that takes hold, you actually do believe that what is happening is real. And then we have an actor that is playing, unbeknownst obviously to the participant, is actually playing the role of the other party, if you will, of this date. And then you can see how the young person, through the dialogue, and this protocol actually is set up by the psychologist, with the intent of teaching them to recognize when things become uncomfortable and what to do and what to say. Now, sitting here, we might say, well, I know how to do that. I know how to remove that. But the truth is we don't, particularly if there is some tense moments, we don't know really how to respond. And having gone through that in different ways is extremely valuable for a young person to recognize the patterns and to be able to say, you know what, the best thing for me to say at this point is, I really would like to call my mother to come and pick me up, or whatever it is that I want to say, which is exactly what a pilot, the reason that a pilot can land an airplane in the Hudson River without any engines is because they've practiced it many, many times before, or a surgeon who's performed the surgery in a virtual environment many, many times before can actually recognize those dangerous moments, but they're really in a safe and controllable environment. And so that's the opportunity that we have for education outside of the classroom.
Is there any impediment to translating what they learn in these online experiences to the real world? Because, you know, you talk about suspension of disbelief and making certain things realistic, and there's no prescribed outcome. And yet there has to be in the back of people's minds, I'm not really going to get hit. I'm not really going to ruin my entire company's mission. How realistic can you make it so that at some point it actually feels familiar when people are in the real situation?
The research that the Army has done shows that it's extremely effective. The virtual experience and interaction with sufficiently modeled characters, they have to be virtual, but they have to have strong personalities, attitudes, beliefs, values, and so on. In that kind of setting, it makes a major difference in terms of once a soldier is, in fact, in a real Afghani village. Mm-hmm. Statistically, they're finding that the troops are less jittery. They're less suspicious. They present themselves in a very different kind of manner, less fearful. And so the practice, and in some way it's the practice that Peter was talking about with the pilot, the more you get to practice in terms of dealing with someone from a very different culture from your own, the better you're going to be at that process. You learn how not to offend the person, mm-hmm, by offending some virtual characters. Mm-hmm.
When there's not any real risk, but you get to learn the lesson
exactly
from it.
Uh-huh. Exactly. So it does take repeated play. And the game never comes out the same way because there is no pre-scripted scenario. the importance, I think, of identifying what knowledge can be transferred through emphasis on application of principles and emphasis on repetition, so that in a surprise-like environment where you encounter something completely unexpected, you have some training experience. And first responders will talk about that.
So this sort of work is a focus of both of your careers. And I will just say, I don't need to know your exact ages, but you're both out of your 20s. Do you even...
You're so kind.
do you have to sort of make a leap to understand how completely familiar this technology is to younger Americans, and the fact that they really... I mean, do you feel like you've bridged the gap between yourself and the digital natives, or is there still something that you, it almost feels a little bit different, but you can at least put yourself in their shoes?
Well, I mean, personally, my background is in simulation and modeling, and so mm-hmm. I've always appreciated the power of moving pictures. Mm-hmm. To make the jump between the written word to radio, television, to pixels moving on a screen is not really a stretch. I mean, the technologies of interactivity and networking have intermediated everything in our lives. You know, how we work, how we buy an airline ticket. I mean, everything is digital. So you can't. It's not really a stretch. What is interesting to see and to experience is that the facility with which young people can adapt to technology is something that doesn't come to us very comfortably after the age of 50. Or, you know, they're almost like innately able to manipulate and live in a world. I was talking once to a surgeon about the difference between three-dimensional surgery, if you will, in the old days, where you actually touched the things that you were working with in a human body. And now when you're doing it arthroscopically, yeah, you're actually dealing with the world through a flat screen. And yet young surgeons and older surgeons have no problem with that. Once there is that muscle memory, once the brain actually recognizes that certain movements of the body are tied to certain actions that we can perform, it becomes second nature. It becomes innate. Nobody thinks about a professional basketball player doesn't think about shooting a basket.
It just happens.
Mm-hmm. They do it. So I think all of us are obviously making the transition from the non-digital to the digital age in different ways. We have old people now playing the Wii and enjoying it, you know, very much. But we have to recognize the fact that young people who grew up as digital natives, if you will, are truly natives in the sense that they speak it not as a foreign language, but they speak it as a native language.
Peter Rodd, director of the Linda and Mitch Hart eCenter at the Guildhall at SMU, and Tom Linehan, director of the Institute for Interactive Arts and Engineering at UT Dallas, are my guests this hour. We'll be back to our conversation with them in a couple of minutes, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. Jeff Whittington joins us now. Hello again, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Sorry, I was just checking my handheld email system there.
It's very nice. Now, do you consider yourself a digital native, or are you a
I don't know, until
digital immigrant?
Until I think I'm still a newbie. Until November, I still had the free phone. You know, that you got the $19 phone
from like 1997.
No, it was 3 or 4 years old, I guess.
Isn't it funny that that seems old though?
Oh, you should have seen the associate who helped us get our iPhones. You should have seen her face when we pulled out our phones. her chin hit the top of the desk.
We don't see those old timers right. around here.
But
phone would have still worked if you'd wanted to call the number.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you know, any phone will work to call 888-694-6931. But if you can't go online from your phone to KERA.org, then, you know, go to your computer, and maybe you're listening online to the stream, the KERA stream. Maybe you're getting into the digital age with KERA, and KERA is helping get you there. Maybe your first app was the free KERA app that we could have provided for $1.99, but instead we made it totally free because that's how our business model works. We make stuff for free, and we don't make it for free, but we make stuff and let you have access to it for no charge. But then a couple of times a year, we ask that you look in the mirror and say, you know, do I owe KERA a little something for using this content and using this service? And the answer, quite frankly, is yes. We would love for you to take responsibility for the fact that you use the service and make an affordable gift of support.
We love to be here for you in a variety of formats. Many of you we know listen to this show in particular on the podcast. Maybe it's days from the day that we recorded this. We would still encourage you to go online to KERA.org and make a contribution or to call 1-888-694-6931. We mention those things over and over during the fundraising campaigns, but the truth is they're always operational. We are never, we never don't have the capacity to accept and be grateful for a contribution of financial support.
And even if it is days from today, the chances are good that we're still in the membership campaign. So please go to the support page at KERA.org. You can scroll through the available thank you gifts. You can pick your level. There is actually the Think coffee mug is still a viable option for your thank you giftitude if you want to thank yourself and show folks that you listen to the Think Show with your, you know, your coffee. You can use it in a meeting too. You can kind of lift it
raise
up.
Raise it when someone's saying something stupid.
And slow.
You want to indicate to them they ought to think before they speak.
We offer that free of charge with the mug. That particular use of the mug. We don't necessarily condone that that use, but it is yours with our thanks when you join the station at the $60 membership level. And if you choose to spread your membership gift out over the year, you can become a sustaining member, and that's just $5 a month. And you get KERA, and you get this news and information, smart radio, you know, intelligent radio, delivered right to you whenever you need it, wherever you are. What's that worth to you?
1-888-694-6931 is the number, or go online to KERA.org. Perhaps you've been a sustaining member for some time now. Maybe you were doing $10 a month and you think, you know, this year I could do $12 a month. You can certainly call or go online and make an adjustment to your sustaining membership. We would appreciate that if you wanted to increase it. And you're always in control of that, by the way. You set the amount that your sustaining membership is. I think the minimum per month, because of the cost associated on our end, is $5 a month, but you can do pretty much any amount you like beyond that.
888-694-6931. You can do it online at KERA.org. We have just a couple of minutes till we get back to our conversation about the emergence of digital technology and education and what it all means. It's a great conversation. You won't miss a minute of it if you'll go online right now and make your contribution at KERA.org or call 888-694-6931.
Check out Thank You Gifts if you are interested, including from the last hour. We still have copies of India Calling by Anand Giridharadas. That's available at the $120 level or above. We'd love to hear from you now at KERA.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Tom Linehan is with us from the Institute for Interactive Arts and Engineering at UT Dallas. Peter Rodd joins us from the Linda and Mitch Hart E-Center at the Guildhall at SMU. We're speaking this hour about video games and education. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. I'm going to generalize here, but we have had several emails come in this hour, and generally speaking, they are saying, how can you be defending this stuff? My kids are addicted. They do nothing else. Are you tired of having to defend video games to parents who maybe see that they might have some potential but also really worry about how much attention they draw away from real life?
No, I'm not worried at all about that, and we must defend it, and we should continue to speak about it. I think what we're reacting to as parents is legitimate. It's the obviously the amount of time that one is spending playing is an amount of time that's taken away from other things, from doing homework or spending time with the family. I think what we're reacting to though is kind of the early growing pains of our understanding of video games. The educational side has not caught up yet with the entertainment side. So we're actually reacting currently to the entertainment side, which is very legitimate. And as parents, we and no one else should be working with our own children to put boundaries around what they can do and cannot do and for how long. That's our job as parents. But the time will come, and it'll be kind of ironic in a few years from now, when maybe you'll be receiving exactly the opposite emails. Parents will be telling their children, please sit down and continue to work through your homework by playing the video games.
Yeah.
And so the time actually will come. But I think these emails you're getting are quite legitimate. It's an important subject.
We have a research team at UT Dallas that is focusing on tough content games. So not the easy stuff, the really, really hard stuff to learn. And Dr. Monica Evans is leading a group that has developed the Calculus Coach game.
Wow.
Calculus has one of the highest failure rates in the country. Nationally, the failure rate is 30%. And so what is it and when in the learning of calculus do kids begin to fail? And can gaming help address those issues? The same is true of another major gatekeeper course, chemistry. So failing calculus, failing chemistry can keep you out of a myriad of different professions, technical professions, medical and biological professions. So in a sense, we're trying to address and understand how do you get at the really hard stuff by using gaming technology as a motivation?
Can it be fun? You talk about a calculus game, and I apparently was born 25 years too late because my calculus and my chemistry both could have used a boost. But do students, are still they saying, well, this is better maybe than working with a tutor, but I'm not, I would much rather be out shooting hoops with my friends?
It can be fun, mm-hmm. and it is fun, and part of it is that there is a natural motivation when you're in fact learning things, and if you can prove to yourself that you can get to that stage, then the sense of accomplishment begins to kick in. Is the calculus coach game as much fun as some of the others? Dr. Evans is going to keep trying, it's a positive use, I think, of gaming technology.
I think. Really, what's important for us if we're thinking about making video games for learning, we shouldn't think about just the presentation of the content. I mean, a lousy video game is still a lousy video game. It changes nothing. Making a video game in which I'm actually using calculus to get other things done, I would basically not need a test at the end of that, because if I actually get through it, then I will have demonstrated that I have the mastery that is necessary in order to solve problems. I think what's exciting about the potential of digital media and interactive digital media, video games and education, is this whole notion of learning through failure. Failure is a bad word in traditional academia. We never want to fail. I mean, I know in college, if you fail the first test and you only have two left or one left, then the best that you could do is maybe a C or a B minus, God forbid. But learning through failure in a video game means that I am free to try different dimensions and different ways of looking at the same problem. The other thing that is interesting in video games is this whole notion that since I am in charge, then I have an opportunity to learn at my own pace and challenge myself. And so if I want to level up, that's a word that you'll hear a lot in gaming, is that I'm actually leveling up. I'm actually increasing the difficulty level on myself because I want to solve harder and harder problems. And I have the safety net of knowing that I'm doing so in a safe environment. Therefore, if I do fail, it's okay because I can come back and try again and I can actually succeed. So we're still in the very early stages of using and understanding how we can use video games effectively in. We're not going to replace what we do in the classroom. We're not going to replace education as we know it today. We're going to augment it. We're going to add different dimensions to it that will enable our kids to learn, be motivated to learn deeply. And here's one that I would love to see. Not only learn to solve the problems that are presented to us, but learn deeply enough so that we can solve problems that we've never seen before with concepts that we've learned. Mm-hmm. And that's really what deep learning is all about.
I love the idea of something you mentioned a little while ago, Peter, which is the elimination of tests as the only way to guarantee that we know that someone has done something, because, you know, we struggle so much with what tests should look like these days and how to make them fair. What you're talking about is, if it takes the person next to me 10 tries through the calculus game to master it, super. And if it takes me 120, that's fine too, as long as I ultimately get there.
Mm-hmm. What is the objective? Is it for me to learn calculus? Is it for me to learn calculus in 3 minutes?
Yeah.
I think all of us would love to, for all of our children to basically be good at writing, be good at creative reasoning and critical thinking and all those things. And if it takes them 2 minutes longer, then who cares, as long as they actually achieve that. That's the focus, really, that should be testing is important, but we should build the test, or video games, I should say, allow us to build the test as part and parcel of the experience itself, so mm-hmm. that when I do finish the experience, I've actually passed the test.
Yeah.
It's an embedded assessment, not something that you have to do additionally. Being able to meet the levels and performance requires no additional testing.
How do you both respond to the concern that if we put more video games into the classroom day, and no one here is arguing that we will never have teachers and kids are sitting in a study carrel all day with a computer in front of them, but that the more opportunities you give kids to make things fun, the more they enter the adult world with the expectation that they never have to do anything that hasn't been tailor-made to be fun?
I will counter that. I will counter that by saying that the opportunity for a simulation or for the virtual world to represent complexity is far superior to my ability to represent complexity in the classroom. Mm-hmm. I think what is exciting in terms of video games is the fact that in order for us to be able to scale our educational model, we have had to simplify it and we've had to turn it into a linear and didactic process. Whereas in a video game, I can actually introduce cross-disciplinarity. I can actually introduce working in teams. I can do things that we have not found easy to do in the real educational world, if you will. So I don't see it in either or. I don't see it as a kind of a diminishing return or just the pie is fixed. On the contrary, if I can actually have young people learn certain things that are, frankly, didactic or need to be read or need to be written about, then fine. But then if I could take them and put them, let's take, for example, learning a language. If I'm trying to learn a new language, let's say Japanese or French or Italian, would you rather read about it or would you rather actually be immersed, let's say, walking the streets of Paris and sitting in a cafe and ordering a coffee and having people talk to you in the exact context of learning the language? And oh, by the way, wouldn't it also be great to introduce my colleagues who are in the class with me, who are now sitting with me at the cafe, the faculty member is there. Not only that, but I can now begin to learn geography and history in context. We can rewind all together and go visit Louis XIV and see, you know, how is he doing over there in Versailles, and what did Versailles look like? And so all of these things become possible, and adding that complexity become possible, which frankly is difficult when we're dealing in traditional learning. So it's not a question of either or, not a question of spending more time in video games and less time on education. Once we bring them together, they will be the same.
Right. Gamers have very high standards, and they have very deep expectations. So I think it's the reverse is true, that gamers don't expect things to be easy. They expect him to be hard.
Well, this is really exciting stuff, and I so appreciate you both spending this hour with us. I think a lot of cool stuff to think about after the hour is over, so thank you both so much. Tom Linehan is director of the Institute for Interactive Arts and Engineering at UT Dallas. Peter Rodd is director of the Linda and Mitch Hart E-Center at the Guildhall at SMU. We appreciate all of you who have been listening this hour and want to thank you for going online to kera.org to make your contributions and for calling 1-888-694-6933. 1-800-231. Your dollars help to make this kind of programming possible here in North Texas. We are able to do a local show, like think, with some really foremost experts in the country who happen to live here in North Texas. We're able to do this because of your contributions to this station. This is such an interesting conversation. Hopefully some interesting contributions coming in, Jeff. I mean, we could have gone on for hours and hours. These guys were just great and gave me a lot to think about, because I'm not quite a knee-jerk, all video games are bad sort of person, but this conversation helped me sort of reframe the way I think about what video games can be. It was really, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, let us know what you think by calling 888-694-6931 or by contributing online at kera.org. When you contribute online, you can there's a little place where you can put a comment in there. So let us know what you think of the show today and in general. We do the show for you. This is public radio, and we're not saying, gosh, I really hope the Coca-Cola Corporation is happy with our interview today. No, that's not how
it
works.
Maybe some folks who work there, sure, we'd love to please them.
Absolutely. We'd love to please you on an individual basis. Yeah. I mean, that's what this is all about. And we know that you use this service individually. You know, you're not sitting in a big stadium with all the other listeners right now. But, you are a group with a lot of power. You're a member of a group with a lot of power, and you have the power to continue to make public radio a reality here in North Texas. You can do it for as little as $35, or you can give $3,500 to the station. You decide what's right for you. And in case you're wondering what the average gift, it's about $120 is what the average listener and contributor makes to the station. I mean, that's what you typically do. So if that's right for you, then that's great. If it's not, give a little less, give a little more, but please do give today online at kera.org or on the phone at 888-694-6931.
One of the things that, of many, that makes this show such a joy for Jeff and me to work on is that we know that you don't come to the show looking to have all of your opinions reinforced. We know that you don't come to the show expecting that everyone who comes on here is going to say things that you automatically agree with. And we're also delighted that we have no obligation to try to convince you of anything one way or another. It's wonderful to have a space in broadcasting to simply explore ideas. Now, you may hear things that you think, that makes so much sense. You may also hear things and think,
Chris Boyd. I'm kidding.
You may think, well, I disagree with that. But public radio audiences respectfully disagree, which is such a thing that there's not quite enough of that in the world. You in public radio are amazing listening and participating with the show. You understand what we're trying to do. You understand that if we have someone on that you disagree with, it's not because we're trying to convert you. We just want to talk to this person. It's a wonderful space. It's very limited in broadcasting today, and it is made possible in this community by your dollars specifically at kera.org and also at 1-888-694-6931.
Yeah, and consider this, faithful listener of KERA and Think. If we have someone on that you disagree with, we might be doing it because we think you might want to talk to them. How about that? And you know what? The phone lines are usually open, and you usually can. You can always email a question or an answer a question or a comment to a guest on Think. Or, you can call in. And this is a place where everyone is treated with respect. When you disagree with a guest, you're treated with respect, just like you would treat that guest with respect. That's what's so wonderful about public radio. That's what's so wonderful about being able to bring you this show, Think. And we did have some emails that last hour from parents who were thinking, gosh, this video game thing is just taking over the world. And in a sense, it is just taking over the world. but it's nice to be able to make sense of what the digital world is all about. And that's what we were doing today on the show. And, I'm sure we'll revisit this topic down the road. So please do respond, though, to our request, our polite and civil request, that you do your part to help pay for this programming, because it really is necessary that you get involved.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can go online to kera.org. Thank you so much to Natalie Canavati in Dallas, Gail Wright, and Pam Lindley in Fort Worth. Thanks to you if you are preparing to make your contribution or if you already have. Your support really makes it possible. We don't come to you very often to raise money. If you think about it, if you're listening to a commercial station, they come to you several times an hour. Now, they don't ask for your money out of your pocket, but they sell time to advertisers. There's nothing wrong with that model. Everybody knows how it works, and lately it's not working as well as it used to, but it's a way to do it. It's just not the way we do it in public radio. We think it's nice that for the most part, even during the fundraising drives, you get more minutes of content per hour. And certainly when we're not doing the fundraising drives, because of your generosity during these limited time fundraising campaigns.
Yeah, we still bring you that much more content right here on your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. And, of course, always online at KERA.org, where you can always make your tax-deductible, safe, and secure contribution. Just go to KERA.org, click on the support button there. And you know what? The great news is that we're making incredible progress, thanks to so many of you. But we still are waiting to hear from you.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number if you'd like to do it that way. We love it when you embrace the digital age and make your contribution of support online at KERA.org, mostly because it costs a little bit less to process those online contributions. But honestly, we are delighted if you call. If that's what you prefer, we just want to hear from you. Your contributions provide over half of the support it takes to keep KERA strong. So thanks.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.